Good day. Today is Monday, 27th October 2025. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched the programme or that part of the programme that you want to watch, you've liked what you've seen and heard. Well, with that, let me now proceed to the rest of today's programme. And again, I'm going to return to the topic of the situation in Ukraine, where things continue to move very quickly on the battlefronts, but where we've also received some interesting further information from the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, which to some extent at least provides many of the answers about the events of the last few months and clarifies an awful lot of the uncertainties and of the mysteries. Anyway, let's focus first on the situation on the battlefronts. Yesterday, as I said in my programme, the Russians, the chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces, General Gerasimov, and Putin, the president of Russia, had a meeting of which the Kremlin provided us with the introductory words. And over the course of those words, we learnt that the Russian military is reporting to Putin that the Ukrainian garrisons in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk have both been encircled and that the battle in these two important towns is therefore coming close to the point of decision, the final point of decision. And Putin's spokesman, Peskov, a short time after, provided a further information about the ongoing state of these battles. And he says, he explained that the situation in Pokrovsk involves the encirclement of 5,500 Ukrainian troops, and in Kupiansk, a slightly smaller number of Ukrainian troops, around 5,000 there, have also been encircled. Anyway, that is what Peskov said. And that's what we've heard from Gerasimov and from Putin. Now, we've had more information from the Russian Defense Ministry today. The Russian Defense Ministry is now continuing with its modern practice of providing us with regular updates about the state of the battle. And this morning, shortly before I started making this program, they provided this update about the situation in Kupiansk and in Pokrovsk. Russian units continue to eliminate hostile troops surrounded in Kupiansk and Pokrovsk. Now, to repeat again, point I made before, the Russians, including in these summaries, always refer to Pokrovsk as Krasnoarmeysk. The Soviet name still used for this town in Russia. I have consistently referred to it as Pokrovsk. I will continue to use the name Pokrovsk when I repeat or read these Russian Defense Ministry summaries. But just to repeat again, the town is named in these summaries Krasnoarmeysk, not Pokrovsk, but we are talking about Pokrovsk. Anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry then goes on to say, in Kupiansk, four attempts of Ukrainian formations to break through the encirclement to reach the right bank of the Oskol River, in other words, that means the west bank of the Oskol River, over the destroyed water crossings near Petrovka were foiled. As a result, artillery and drone strikes eliminated up to 50 Ukrainian troops, 6 units of armoured hardware, including two Humvee armoured fighting vehicles. So, the Russians are claiming that the Ukrainian troops, the 5,000 Ukrainian troops on the left bank of the Oskol River, who are surrounded, have been trying to escape. They've been trying to find ways to cross the Oskol River onto the west bank, but they have been unsuccessful and they are suffering losses as a result of these attempts. And in fact, there were more reports yesterday from various mapping projects and bloggers and reporting channels about the situation in Kupiansk. And the general consensus of all of them, including the Ukrainian ones, was that the Russians are continuing to expand the territory that they control in and around the city of Kupiansk, tightening the siege of the Ukrainian troops who are trapped in the industrial buildings on the east bank of the Oskol River. Now, this morning, there were reports that the land forces commander of the Ukrainian army, the commander of the Ukrainian ground troops, overall commander of the Ukrainian ground troops, General Drapaty, who, by the way, and for the record, is widely liked in Ukraine. There's been various attempts to at least say that he is a relatively competent and humane officer. There's no suggestion that he is anything other than completely committed to Ukraine itself. There's no doubting of his loyalty, but that he is a competent and humane commander who, it is known, has a very tense and very difficult relationship with General Sirski, who is constantly undermining him and trying to sack him, just to say. Anyway, the reports say that General Drapaty this morning has given an order to the Ukrainian troops who are trapped in these industrial buildings east of the Oskol River to escape any way they can. They have been told that they don't need to hold on to their positions any further. So that is the report that I've seen. I obviously don't have conclusive confirmation of it. It may be the General Sirski, who, as I said, seems to have rivalry with General Drapaty, will try to countermand this order. But anyway, the Ukrainians have been told to try to escape from these positions on the east bank of the Oskol River. And I understand, by the way, that Drapaty's order extends to all other Ukrainian troops in the Kupiansk area. They have been basically told to evacuate or abandon, if you prefer, the entire town. Drapaty has concluded that Kupiansk is irretrievably lost and that there is no purpose any longer in trying to defend the Ukrainian positions, footholds that might still exist there. So I don't know what the Ukrainian troops who are trapped on the east bank of the Oskol River are going to do. I don't know how they can execute Drapaty's order, assuming that it is not countermanded. They are, after all, caught in a trap. And it could be that Drapaty, who, as I said, is showing signs of realism and humanity, by the way, in my opinion, in my general belief, realism and humanity almost always go together. Just saying, not just in military affairs, but in all other areas of life. But anyway, my understanding, my sense of the situation is that perhaps Drapaty will eventually recognize the inevitable And if it were left to him, he would allow these soldiers on the east bank of the Oskol River to lay down their arms and to surrender en masse to the Russians. Of course, Sirski and Zelensky will never agree to that. And should such a thing ever happen, there is no doubt at all that the order would be immediately countermanded and that Drapati would be dismissed. But anyway, logically, that appears to be where we are heading towards. Now, there's been reports for some time that the Ukrainian troops east of the Oskol River are running out of supplies of food and ammunition and fuel. And apparently their situation, well, not apparently, obviously their situation is worsening by the day. And it's worth remembering that we are now in October, late October. Weather conditions will continue to get worse. It's going to get colder. It's going to get wetter. At some point, the snow will come. The snow, by the way, initially might even be a relief. It might be easier to cope with the snow than it would be with rain, just to say. But anyway, whatever. There will come a point where it becomes impossible, unendurable, to continue to resist on the east bank of the Oskol River. And we will see what happens. Anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry then discusses the situation in Pokrovsk. It says, in Pokrovsk, assault detachments of the Second Army, this is a Russian force, conduct resolute offensive actions to increase a control zone near a railway terminal. Now, we're not told which one, because there are several. But I am going to make a guess that it is the railway terminal that the Russians captured some days ago in the southern part of Pokrovsk. It said that there are still Ukrainian troops in that area, and the Russians are pushing north from this railway terminal and are moving steadily towards cutting off Ukrainian positions, remaining positions in Mirnograd from the remaining garrison in Pokrovsk. And the Russian Defense Ministry went on to say, over the course of the day, more than 60 Ukrainian troops, 2 armored fighting vehicles and 3 motor vehicles were neutralized. Again, I'm not sure what neutralized means. Destroyed, killed, wounded, captured, who knows? But anyway, that is what the Russian Defense Ministry says. Now, the Ukrainians, for their part, are now starting to become more alarmed, or more publicly alarmed, about the situation in Pokrovsk. Zelensky has made certain comments about how the situation in Pokrovsk is becoming very difficult. Critical, I believe, is the word he used. He said that the Russians have entered Pokrovsk, which, of course, is true. They have indeed entered Pokrovsk, but he sort of implies that this is something that has happened over the last couple of days. They have, in fact, been well within, inside Pokrovsk, since at least the end of August. But anyway, Zelensky is now acknowledging that the situation in Pokrovsk is becoming more dangerous. And his words are coming at the same time as we have had reports of Ukrainian counterattacks north of Pokrovsk. This is the area northeast of Pokrovsk where the Russians achieved their breakthrough in August, and specifically north of the small town of Rodinska, which lies immediately to the north of Pokrovsk. There are reports, not so far confirmed by the Russian Defense Ministry, that the Russians captured the whole of Rodinska about 2 days ago, sealing the cauldron in Pokrovsk. The Ukrainians claim to be pushing south towards Rodinska. Presumably, they're trying to recapture Rodinska. Presumably also to allow an escape route for the Ukrainian troops who are trapped in Pokrovsk. Probabilities are that the Russians will move reinforcements there. Putin gave clear orders to Gerasimov that the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk needed to be blocked. In other words, this time the Russians are agreed that the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk must not be allowed to escape. I believe that the Russians have all of the resources that they need to ensure that the trap in Pokrovsk remains shut. And literally, over the last couple of seconds, even as I'm making this program, I read again from the Russian Defense Ministry another report, an Iskander M operational tactical missile system and a Sukhoi 34 fighter bomber delivered, or Sukhoi 34 fighter bombers, plural, delivered strikes at a concentration of manpower, weaponry and military hardware of Ukraine's 67th Separate Mechanized Brigade near Vodolazhskoye in Pokrovsk's direction. So I don't know where this place is, but it is clearly somewhere in the Pokrovsk area. And it seems to me as if the Russians are now conducting airstrikes and missile strikes to repel Ukrainian counterattacks and to keep this particular cauldron, the Pokrovsk cauldron, firmly shut. Now, there are other battles taking place in other places. There are more reports now that the Russians have indeed entered the town of Liman, west of Slavyansk. Oh, sorry, east of Slavyansk. And there are also further reports of fighting in Seversk, as I say, with Dronovka having been captured by the Russians, and nobody disputes that, and with the Russians claiming that they're now on the brink of capturing Yampol, the Ukrainian troops in Siversk are going to be in another cauldron as well. But anyway, it's the situation in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk, which inevitably currently is attracting the most attention. So that is the battle at the present time. It is intensifying, and the trap around these Ukrainian troops is closing. And Zelensky's words and Drapati's reported order show that the Ukrainians know that in Donbass they are in serious trouble. Now, at the same time, over the course of last night, the Russians conducted another massive combined drone and missile strike on Ukrainian positions right across Ukraine. And the Ukrainian authorities have delayed, I think for the first time ever, the start of the heating season in Ukraine. Now, this is a product of Soviet household industrial management. During the period of the Soviet Union, the Soviet state, it was the Soviet state that built all of the apartment buildings. It was the Soviet state that provided the heating services. And the way it was done, and it was extremely well organized, by the way, was that central heating systems in apartment buildings were turned on at particular periods of the year, centrally by the central Soviet authorities to cover the winter. And then they would be switched off again on a specific date in the spring. So this would happen for an entire apartment building and for all the apartment buildings in an entire city. The heating would be switched on in all of these buildings, in all of these apartments at the same time. And it might have, by the way, consequences. Sometimes during a thaw, for example, the temperature would rise and the central heating would still be on in the apartments. And for most of the Soviet period, it was not possible in these apartments to dial down the heating that the central heating was providing. And the result was that apartments could become extremely stuffy and overheated, sometimes in winter. And it was not unknown for people to open the windows in winter to try to cool things down a little in the apartments. Anyway, I'm not going to engage further in historical reminiscences about this. There are, I noticed people from Russia who comment on the threads of these programs, and they can provide an awful lot more detail and colour to this topic than I'm going to do in this program. Suffice to say that in Kiev, the authorities have announced that they are delaying the start of the heating season in Kiev. And the reason is, obviously, because the energy complex in Kiev is on the brink of complete collapse. They are not able to provide heating to Kiev, and for that reason, they have postponed the start of the heating season. And this is going to reproduce itself in much of Ukraine over the next couple of weeks and months. There are reports that the situation with heating is bad over increasing numbers of Ukrainian cities. The east of Ukraine, the industrial cities in the eastern center of Ukraine, appear to be the most affected. But I've seen pictures from Lvov, the capital of western Ukraine, at the far western end of Ukraine. And it seems that, if these pictures are correct, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but it looks as if water supply in Lvov broke down as a result of the Russian missile and drone strikes. And there were lines of people apparently collecting water from various water dispensers. And it does seem to be, therefore, that there is now a general crisis across, ahead of the winter season, in all parts of Ukraine, that cities are being affected, in the east certainly, but in the centre of Ukraine also, perhaps even in the west as well. Now, this tells us a number of important things. Firstly, it tells us about the ruthlessness with which this war is again being conducted. The Russians started the special military operation, making public assurances that they would not seek to interfere with the civilian life of the population of Ukraine, that they would only target the Ukrainian army. That was, I remember, being said by the Russians in February 2022. And in the first weeks and months of the war, they stuck with that fairly closely. Then, after an attack on the Kerch Bridge in October 2022, they began to attack for the first time the Ukrainian electricity and power generating system. And they've done that repeatedly every winter, but they have up to now avoided taking steps that would cause the system to collapse completely. This winter, it looks different. It looks as if the Russians have thrown aside all inhibitions, that they're now working to destroy the entire functioning part of Ukraine's energy system, and that they are not just heedless of the effect this is going to have on civilians, but they are clearly doing it with a purpose to impact on civilians as well. Now, to say this straightforwardly, this is an extremely disturbing development indeed. It is something that always happens in every war. All Western air wars eventually result in attacks of this kind. If we're talking about Western air wars, they're much more aggressively conducted than even what we are seeing from the Russians now. But the point is that the Russians are now doing it, and I can't help but think that one of the objectives is basically to get more of the civilian population to evacuate the cities and perhaps leave Ukraine itself, though it ought to be said that the Ukrainian authorities place barriers on who can leave. The frontiers are carefully guarded. If the intention is to provoke an exodus from Ukraine, it might be possible. It might be very difficult for this to be carried out. But anyway, a blackout of the cities is going to create a much worse economic crisis for Ukraine. And it's very difficult to see how it can not affect civilian morale and deepen the sense of crisis in Ukraine as the Russian army continues to close in. It also means something else, which is, of course, that the Russians probably are now preparing serious plans to storm the cities themselves. They don't want to attack the cities whilst there are large numbers of civilians there. They don't want to be caught in a situation where they're accused of killing civilians in battles. So they want to create conditions in which the civilians themselves leave. As I said, the calculus now is becoming increasingly ruthless. And I go back to an article that John Helmer wrote back in 2022 at the start of Russia's missile campaign against the energy system. I remember he wrote it at that time based on advice he was being given by, if I remember rightly, an American technician. And this person said to Helmer, according to Helmer, that the attacks on the energy system by the Russians at that time were not intended, or did not appear to be intended, to knock out the energy system in its entirety. Rather, they were intended to enable the Russians to get a clear understanding, not just of how the energy system in Ukraine worked, but about how the Ukrainians would try to repair it and in order to keep it in operation. And the intention was to give the Russians such a clear picture of all of this that when the big Russian offensive finally came, the Russians would be able not just to knock out the energy system on a temporary basis, but to do so in a way that preempted any repair, in effect knocking it out completely. And it seems to me that what we are seeing take place now is consistent with a big Russian offensive, the kind of big Russian offensive that Helmer was talking about in that article of 3 years ago. In other words, the Russians are now so far advanced on the battlefields in Donbass and elsewhere that they are starting to think that the moment may be coming when the big offensive will need to be launched. And for that reason, they're taking the steps now towards shutting the energy system completely down. The Western media is now starting to discuss this. I've seen articles about this in the British media, in The Guardian, and in the Financial Times. And interestingly, there is a general acknowledgement that there is absolutely nothing anymore that the West can do to change this. Apparently, in one of the endless numbers of meetings that the European officials have had, there was general agreement that the priority should be to try to assist Ukraine with its air defences, except, of course, that there is nothing the West can do to assist Ukraine with its air defences. There are not enough Patriot missile interceptors, as we've been reading about many times. There are not enough airspeed missile systems. There are not enough air defence systems even to provide Western Europe with air defence coverage. There just isn't any means now to help Ukraine. And, well, there's been talk about sending Western air forces into Western Ukraine to shoot down Russian incoming Russian drones and missiles. But as the New York Times pointed out a couple of weeks ago, if that were ever to happen, the number of these drones and missiles is now so huge that very quickly, even if the Russians took no countermeasures, the Western air forces would rapidly run out of air-to-air missiles to shoot these drones and missiles down. So there is no answer to this, just as there is no answer to the deteriorating situation of the Ukrainians on the Donbass battlefronts. In fact, I was reading articles that have been appearing in the German media, which say that over the course of the summer, weapons deliveries from the West to Ukraine have fallen by around 40%, and that the decline continues. And to repeat again, this is not because the West doesn't want to send weapons to Ukraine. It is because inventories are now so run down, the ability to produce weapons is now so reduced that the ability to keep Ukraine armed and supplied with weapons is diminishing all the time. And now this brings me to the diplomacy. And the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, as I said at the start of this programme, has now provided us with a very, very interesting interview, which he gave to a Hungarian YouTube channel, one which the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, also sometimes gives interviews to. And Lavrov's interview is extremely interesting and, I would argue, important because it has clarified an awful lot of the uncertainties about what has been happening over the last few weeks or months, extending all the way back to July, when the interactions between the Americans and the Russians intensified, leading to the summit meeting in Alaska and leading to the debacle of the collapsed summit meeting that it looked as if would happen in Budapest, but which the US president has called off. And there's been some interesting articles in Bloomberg which explain the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio's position. Anyway, this is the single most important section of this interview that Lavrov gave. And I'm going to just read it. I'm not going to read the entire interview, but this is, for me, the most important part. He says this, when President Putin came to Alaska, the agenda which he followed was the one which had been brought to Moscow by Steve Witkoff a few days before. We looked into the proposals which Witkoff brought, and we said that we need to think about them. Then in Alaska, President Putin said to Trump that he is ready to cooperate on the basis of the concept and the framework which the envoy of President Trump, in other words, Witkoff, brought to Moscow, and which they continued to discuss in Alaska. President Putin repeated each and every element of the concept, which was brought by Witkoff, and was asking Witkoff, who was present at the discussions in Anchorage, is this right? Is this right? Everything was confirmed. Then President Putin said that we're ready to accept this concept. That's how we believe we can move forward in specific terms on the basis of what the United States side proposed. At that point, there was no direct response from the Americans. They agreed that they would take some time to think about it. President Trump said he needed to talk to his allies, who came to Washington the next day and brought Zelensky with them. President Putin, of course, briefed our allies and strategic partners, but the court was there on the American side. They proposed something which we eventually were ready to accept. And then Lavrov goes on to say, I reminded Rubio about the sequence of events, and Rubio, this is over the course of their latest telephone call, the one which is supposed to have led to the breakdown, the cancellation of the Budapest summit. And then according to Lavrov, Rubio said, yes, we're still considering, we are trying, we are interested. So I'm going to suggest that this is almost certainly indeed what happened, and it clarifies things clearly, and it confirms my long-running suspicion that the proposal that the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass and that in return the Russians agree to a Zaporozhye-Kherson ceasefire came from the Americans. In fact, if we follow what Lavrov is saying here, it seems that Witkoff came with this proposal to Moscow and put it to Putin. And Putin said, yes, we are prepared to consider this. This is different. Up to that point, the Ukrainians had first refused any ceasefire at all, any freeze of the conflict at all. Then in March, they said that they were prepared to freeze the conflict on the existing front lines. The Russians repeatedly said that this is unacceptable and that there cannot be any further movement so long as this remains the Ukrainian and American position. And then someone, and it's clear from Lavrov's words, that someone was none other than Donald Trump himself, sent Witkoff to Moscow with the proposal in order to break the deadlock, the proposal that the Russians agree to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region in return for the Ukrainians pulling out of Donbass. So this was an American proposal. It was not one that Putin proposed. All reports in the media that said that Putin offered Witkoff over the course of the meeting in Moscow, that it was Putin who offered to Witkoff a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region in return for a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass. All of those reports are wrong. They are not only wrong, they are clearly an exercise in intentional spinning and misrepresentation on the part of someone. I will discuss that perhaps in another program. It was the Americans, Witkoff and Trump. The Russians were sure that Witkoff came to Moscow with Trump's proposal, who proposed this idea to them. And Putin said, yes, we are prepared to talk about this. It's not what we had ourselves suggested, but this is the idea. This is an idea. It's a serious idea. It's an interesting idea that we are prepared to look at. And then Lavrov says that the Russians, on that basis, agreed to the meeting with Trump, and they clearly came to the meeting in Alaska based on this American proposal. And Putin clearly went to Alaska believing that he would get Trump's agreement and that this would seal the deal. And Bloomberg, interestingly, has just admitted to the same thing, that the Russians came to Alaska believing, expecting that Trump would confirm to Putin directly the proposal there, and that if the Russians accepted it, that would, in the end, that would in effect settle the war. The Ukrainians would withdraw from Donbass. There would be a ceasefire in Kherson and Zaporozhye region. It is clear that the proposal went well beyond this. It seems to me, if I'm going to say it straightforwardly, that the Russians were probably provided with some assurances, probably by Witkoff himself, that eventually Zaporozhye and Kherson regions would indeed be transferred to Russia. But this is a guess. But anyway, the Russians assumed that if they came to Anchorage, met with Trump, told Trump, look, we are prepared to run with this proposal. We will withdraw, sorry, we will stop in Zaporozhye and Kherson region if, on the basis that the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass, the Russians went to Anchorage, thinking, assuming that they would get that agreement from Trump. And according to Lavrov, Putin then went through the entire proposal. There was no lecture about Bogdan Khmelnytsky and Mazepa and history and all of that, as that completely misleading, entirely false article in the Financial Times pretended. The one which appeared about 10 days ago. There was no lecture of that kind from Putin. What Putin actually did, what Lavrov says Putin actually did, was that in Witkoff's and Trump's presence, Putin went step by step through the proposal that Witkoff brought with him to Moscow. And Trump, and Putin said to Trump, "And Witkoff, is this right? Is this indeed your proposal?" Witkoff repeatedly in Trump's presence said yes. And Putin then said, "Look, this is a compromise we can work with. We are prepared at this point, at this time, to agree." And that was the moment when everything fell apart. Now, the American side, Bloomberg and all of these people, have now provided us with an understanding of what lay behind this American proposal. And it was clearly an American proposal. The Americans, Trump and his people, had come to the conclusion in the summer, in the late spring and early summer, that the Russians would soon capture Donbass. And it's understandable that they would do that, because after all, just a few weeks before, the Ukrainian defences in Kursk region had collapsed, and in April, the Russians began their offensive, which appeared to prioritise the situation in Donbass. So clearly there was a discussion in the United States, a discussion which appears to have involved Trump himself, and the discussion, as a result of that discussion, the view was arrived at that in order to end the war, the United States would agree with Russia that Donbass would be transferred entirely to Russia, that the Ukrainians would pull out of Donbass, that there would be a halt in the fighting in Zaporozhye and Kherson region and in other places. And from that point on, there would be a detailed discussion, a negotiation to try to resolve what the Russians referred to as the root causes of the conflict. Ukraine remaining neutral, becoming neutral again, demilitarization, denuclearization, all of those things. But they would, all of that would take place in a negotiation that would ensue once the Ukrainian army had withdrawn from Donbass, had abandoned this line of cities, its major fortified line, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, Pokrovsk, all of those places. And that made sense because Ukraine was on the brink of losing all of these places anyway. And if the Russians captured Donbass, then the main leverage, the bargaining chip, the United States, and by the way, Ukraine, would also have with the Russians, would be lost. And of course, were that to happen, the likelihood would be that the Russians at that point would escalate their demands. Now, that is what the Americans thought. They thought that they could make this concession to the Russians in the summer because they assessed that Ukraine was about to lose or would lose or would soon lose Donbass. And what happened then? It's not at all difficult now to reconstruct it. Is that Zelensky, who has no intention from retreating from a millimetre of Ukrainian territory, and who has no interest anyway in any kind of peace agreement with the Russians, certainly not the kind of peace agreement in which he would have to address Russia's various demands and terms. Anyway, Zelensky categorically rejected any idea of Ukraine retreating from Donbass. The Europeans categorically rejected any idea of Ukraine retreating from Donbass. And they all circulated the story and have continued to do since then. And they've received backing from people like Kellogg in the United States and General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that the idea that the Russians were going to capture Donbass soon was wrong, and that far from the Russian offensive in Donbass being successful, it was failing, that it was Ukraine that was therefore likely to succeed and would hold out, and that there was no point therefore in making these kind of concessions about Donbass to the Russians. And these arguments were clearly made to Trump before the summit meeting in Alaska took place. As we know, Trump had telephone calls with the Europeans. Some of those telephone calls didn't go particularly well. The Europeans insisted over the course of those calls that Ukraine's right, so-called right, Ukraine's destiny to join NATO and the EU should not be compromised. The Europeans also appear to have insisted that the ceasefire had to be on the existing conflict lines. Zelensky insisted to Trump that Ukraine was not in the process of losing Donbass. They all talked about Ukraine needing security guarantees and all of those things. And disastrously, Trump apparently wavered, and instead of following through with the very proposal which he himself had made when he met Putin in Alaska, instead of telling Putin, yes, this is our proposal, this is our plan, this is what we will support, he told Putin, no, we have to pull back. We have to actually, first of all, consult with our allies. To repeat Lavrov's words here, President Putin said that we are ready to accept America's concept. That's how we believe we can move in specific terms on the basis of what the Americans proposed. That was what Putin said to Trump. Then there was no direct response. That's Lavrov's words. They agreed that they should take some time to think about it, some time to think about the proposal which they themselves, the Americans, had made, the proposal that had lured Putin to Alaska. And Lavrov goes on to say, President Trump, he said, he needs to talk to his allies, who, as you remember, came to Washington next day. Actually, it wasn't next day. It was about a week later. So Trump made a proposal to Putin via Witkoff, stop in Kherson, Zaporozhye region, and in return the Ukrainians will pull out of Donbass. The Russians took some time to think it through. I'm going to say I am confident that there was almost certainly a lot of argument about this in Moscow. This would be a very hard sell in Moscow indeed. But Putin was prepared to go along with it. Putin went to Anchorage, checked with Witkoff and Trump that this was indeed the proposal, that he'd understood the proposal correctly, told Witkoff and Trump, yes, after much thought, the Russians are prepared to agree. And then after Putin said that, Trump backed off. He said, well, you know, this might be my proposal, but we don't have a deal here. I'm going to go away and I'm going to speak to the Europeans and I'm going to speak to Zelensky and I'm going to go back and I'm going to then give you the answer. And Bloomberg tells us that, again, the reason is that Trump and Rubio have come round to accepting the narrative that Ukraine is indeed successfully defending Donbass. This is a disaster. This is awful. It cannot be said too strongly how bad this looks, and one can understand the impatience that's been building up in Moscow over the last couple of months, why Trump has been unable to come back and explain to the Russians why he is not following through on what it turns out was his own offer. And it also explains why Trump pulled out of the summit meeting in Budapest. Because Trump doesn't want to confront Putin and tell Putin to his face that he's going back on the proposal he made, which Putin himself had accepted. Now, there are going to be many people in Moscow. In fact, I can say for an absolute certainty that there are going to be many people in Moscow who are saying to Putin at this time, you were absolutely wrong to think that any agreement you made with Trump would survive for any period of time. Trump makes proposals, but as we repeatedly see, he is unable to follow through with them. Well, this, in my opinion, now brings us to the key point. Because the argument, the reason that the Americans are saying to each other why they pulled the offer they had made to the Russians, which the Russians actually accepted, that the Russians are about to capture Donbass. It turns out that assessment, that original American assessment, was right. The Russians are indeed on the brink of capturing Donbass. They've encircled the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk. They've encircled the Ukrainians in Kupiansk. They're broken into Konstantinovka and fighting is going on there. Siversk will soon fall. Liman will soon fall. That leaves only Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And as I've discussed many times, without these other places to prop them up, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk look to me to be undefendable, which is what I am confident, I am sure that they are. The Americans, by pulling back, pulling their own proposal, by reversing themselves on their own proposal after the Russians had accepted this, at least after Putin had accepted it, are throwing away not just the prospect of agreeing this deal with the Russians. They are throwing away, they've thrown it away at precisely that moment when their leverage is about to be lost. I don't think there's any doubt about this now. As I said, the articles in Bloomberg, the the reports in the media and Lavrov's latest interview make the whole sequence of events now entirely clear. There is no doubt about what has happened anymore. What is going to happen then when Pokrovsk and Kupiansk and Siversk and Liman all fall? When the Ukrainian troops in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, assuming that Zelensky is not going to withdraw them, when those troops are also surrounded? Will the Americans come back and try to revive this proposal that they put to Putin back in August and which Putin at the summit meeting in Alaska said that he would be prepared to agree to? Will the Americans do that? Will they go back there? Of course, the whole situation will have changed completely by this time. Ukraine will be in blackout, most likely. Donbass will have been almost done. A concession, what might have looked like a real concession in the summer, the pullback from Donbass, is not going to look like a concession today, because the Russians will indeed be very close to capturing Donbass. And it is important again to stress that the deal Putin thought he had with Trump, and which he thought he was agreeing with Trump in Anchorage, would have been an exceptionally hard sell in Moscow anyway, even at that time. Over the course of his interview with the Hungarian YouTube channel, Lavrov repeatedly points out that Zaporozhye and Kherson regions are historic Russian regions. He talks at length about how these territories became part of Russia. He refers to Catherine the Great and how Catherine the Great founded and established Crimea, founded and gained control of Crimea and founded and established Odessa. He says that it is a mistake to refer to these territories as new territories. They are, on the contrary, historic Russian territories, which, as a result of a political decision made during the era of the Soviet Union by the Soviet leaders, accidentally found themselves within Ukraine. Moreover, many people in Moscow, and I don't mean just the generality of the Russian public, unquestionably the leadership of the military, unquestionably many people in the Russian foreign ministry, in the Russian defense and security establishment, would have said to Putin, look, whatever promises you might have been given about long-term negotiations over the future resolution of the conflict in Ukraine, whatever promises the Americans gave you, including perhaps about the eventual transfer of Zaporozhye and Kherson city regions to us, the reality is that the Americans are not going to keep them, just as they have never kept any promise, any understanding, any agreement we have made with them in the past. Trying to come back now, after the Americans walked back on their own offer in Anchorage, is something which I think even Putin is going to find it exceptionally difficult to do. As I said already, within the Russian political system, I think that he is becoming increasingly isolated in his continued desire to come to some kind of understanding, long-term understanding, with the United States. Now, this, in my opinion, is why Kirill Dmitriev is currently in the United States. There are clearly some people in Washington, Witkoff undoubtedly is one, who are deeply embarrassed by what has happened over the last few months. They, of course, know the whole story of what really took place during Witkoff's visit to Moscow and during the summit meeting in Alaska. They also understand very well that the Russians are indeed going to capture Donbass before very long. Dmitriev's purpose in going to Washington, from the Russian point of view, as I said, there's no doubt that he's the invitation for him, his coming, came from the American side. But from the Russian point of view, at least from Putin's point of view, the purpose of his visit is to explain to the Americans two things. Firstly, that Donbass is indeed going to fall soon, that there is no question that it is the Russians who are winning in Donbass. This is something that Putin, as we know, went to great trouble to try to explain to Trump over the course of their telephone call 10 days ago. And we can now see why. And there is no question that the Russians are winning the war and are going to take control of Donbass before very long. But secondly, what Dmitriev is probably also trying to get the Americans to understand is that once Donbass falls, the scope for compromise has gone. The Americans, the Ukrainians, the Western powers will have nothing left to trade. It is going to be all but impossible to persuade people in Moscow to stop in Zaporozhye and Kherson region. Even Putin, who made his disgust and anger with Trump perfectly clear over the course of his latest press conference, almost certainly will not be interested in returning to the anchorage formula if, or rather when, Donbass has fallen entirely under Russian control. So this is where we are. Now, many will say that it is remarkable that Putin still wants to maintain some kind of negotiation with the Americans after all that has happened, after the debacle of Anchorage, because clearly Anchorage was a debacle, and we've had several Russian officials, like the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, ultimately say that after the debacle of Anchorage, they will be saying, well, it's a bad idea to trust the Americans anyway, but to think that Trump is any different and that you can trust him is absurd. And, well, after Donbass is under Russian control, all of those voices will probably become unanimous voices across the entire Russian political system, and they will include Putin himself. In a recent program, at the time when the Budapest summit was first being talked about, I said that that looked to me to be the last ditch attempt to try to get the Anchorage process back on course. I think that would have been true had that summit meeting actually taken place. I think the last desperate, last-ditch attempt to try to put the pieces back together after the diplomatic fiasco which we have seen over the last couple of weeks. I think that's the last one is going to be Kirill Dmitriev's visit to Washington and the discussions that he has with people there. In the event that nothing comes out of this meeting, and I don't frankly see how it can, and given the current progress of events on the battlefields in the Donbass, I think that the window for a diplomatic settlement of the conflict will have firmly shut, at which point, as I said, we will be looking at military developments and military developments alone, and that will be the only matter with respect to the conflict in Ukraine that will be meaningful anymore. The whole strange period since Donald Trump became president and the various diplomatic initiatives that he has launched will have run their course and will have been visibly seen to have failed. Now, there are just a few more things about Ukraine that I want to talk about, the conflict in Ukraine, which I want to talk about briefly before I touch on other matters. Firstly, I have noticed that over the last couple of days, there has been a notable hardening of line on the part of the Russians with respect to long-range missile strikes on Russia. As I discussed in my programme yesterday, the Russian media have said that Donald Trump's sanctions against Rosneft and Lukoil do not, in fact, in and of themselves, cross any Russian red lines. But deployment of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine absolutely would, and by extension, missile strikes upon Russia using Tomahawk missiles would also cross a Russian red line as well. Some Russian officials and some Russian commentators have recently expanded that to include all long-range missile strikes. Missile strikes by Taurus missiles, for example, or Storm Shadow missiles. If those were to take place, the Russians are now once again reiterating that that would cross the red line, their red line, and that this time, in contrast to what happened in November, they would react and react strongly. And of course, they're in a much better position to react now than they were last year, because the Oreshnik missile system that was still in development last year was tested once, but now they have serial production of Oreshnik missiles. They're entering deployment, and the Russians therefore are able to conduct missile strikes using conventional warheads with hypersonic weapons against targets anywhere in Europe, and they probably want us to think that they're prepared to do that, certainly if missile strikes continue to be conducted against them. One senior Russian politician, very senior Russian politician, Sergei Stepashin, he was briefly Prime Minister of Russia in the 1990s when he was succeeded by none other than Vladimir Putin himself. Anyway, Stepashin, who is still a prominent personality in Russian politics and who I believe heads the Russian Lawyers Association. Anyway, he has come forward and has said that the Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missile, which has just completed development and which is about to enter service with the Russian military, is regarded in Russia as an equivalent weapon to the Tomahawk missile if the United States is unwise enough to start deploying Tomahawk missiles to Europe, not even to Ukraine, but to Europe itself, establishing land-based missiles of that kind, then the Russians will counter using the Burevestnik. And the implication is that these missiles, these Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missiles, will be kept in semi-permanent station, operating over the Arctic or the Atlantic, loitering there for hours or days at a time, ready to accept instructions from Moscow in order to launch strikes against the United States. Well, I hope that this nightmare of scenario, to put it mildly, never materializes. I think if that were to happen, it would elevate tensions between the United States and Russia to stratospheric levels, as I discussed yesterday. But it is Stepashin who has now made the linkage between Tomahawk missiles and Burevestnik missiles, not me. And I think, given his experience and his long-standing role in Russian politics, it would be extremely unwise indeed to ignore what he's saying. Anyway, the Russians, for the record, are now making it extremely clear that they're hardening up again their red line on missile strikes. And Stepashin, for the record, said that given Russia's possession of the Burevestnik, he doesn't any longer believe that threats of Tomahawk missile strikes on Russia, deep inside Russia, that those threats will ever materialize. Dmitriev, incidentally, says that as part of his various discussions with people he's meeting in the United States, he intends to explain to them the implications of the deployment, the development and deployment of the Burevestnik missile and what it can do. And obviously that too is linked in some way, in some form, to the Tomahawks and the question of American future deployment of Tomahawk missiles in Europe. Anyway, there we go. That is what Stepashin and Dmitriev are saying. Donald Trump himself, by the way, when asked about the Burevestnik missile, simply said, "Well, I don't really see what difference it makes. We already have our nuclear submarines positioned close to Russia, and we can launch missiles using submarine-launched ballistic missiles against Russia at any time." That is, of course, true. And it is equally true of the Russians, by the way. They too can, whenever they wish, launch missile strikes using ballistic missile submarines against the United States. I think that President Trump perhaps doesn't quite fully understand the nature of the capability that the Russians have achieved, or the very destabilizing and dangerous nature of this system. And I would go further, by the way, and I would say that President Trump, in some of his attempts to mock President Putin, perhaps doesn't understand that the Russians can play equally well at that game. For example, he joked after Putin said that the latest sanctions, the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, would not make much difference. Trump joked, well, let Putin come and talk about that with me in 6 months' time. The Russians quite intentionally reacted to that by taking Trump's words at face value and reporting and saying in their media and their public statements that Trump has now committed himself to reviewing the sanctions, the Lukoil and Rosneft sanctions, in 6 months' time. That, of course, was not what Trump meant. The Russians know that that was not what Trump meant. But as I said, they're pretty skilled at playing this game also. Anyway, President Trump himself is, of course, away in Malaysia. He's just been to Malaysia. He's now flying on to South Korea, where he intends, well, he is going to have his big meeting with Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader. And he talks about getting President Xi to put pressure on Russia to end the conflict in Ukraine. It apparently doesn't occur to President Trump that whether or not Xi Jinping ever had any inclination to put pressure on President Putin to end the conflict in Ukraine, President Xi is certainly not going to do so because President Trump asks him to. That utterly precludes that possibility. The leader of China will not want to be seen carrying out errands at the request of the President of the United States. That possibility simply does not exist. But anyway, the United States and China do now seem to be moving forward towards some kind of trade agreement of some kind, possibly. The Americans have been talking very optimistically about the results of their meetings with the Chinese officials in Malaysia. I have to say that I've been reading carefully the Chinese media, and they seem to be a lot less euphoric about the progress of these meetings. Meetings have been relatively short. They've only lasted for about 2 days. It is inconceivable to me that the whole vast topic of US-Chinese trade can have been agreed and sorted out over meetings which in aggregate cannot have lasted much more than a few hours. It is likely that the Chinese negotiators speak English. The American negotiators don't speak Chinese. All discussions will have had to be conducted through interpreters. So the reality is that the meetings have not lasted very long at all. But nonetheless, it's clear that the United States for the moment does want to de-escalate against China. I say that because in every step of escalation that has been taken, it has been clear to me that it is the United States that has been making the running. I suspect that the Chinese decision to tighten up their regulations on rare earths, focused mines in the United States, and probably the shortages of chips formerly exported by China and sold through Nexpedia, which is apparently having an effect on the American and European car industries, I suspect that has concentrated minds further. Another thing that might have affected the American approach to negotiations with China is the Chinese government's extremely tough treatment of Germany. I mentioned in my last program that the German foreign minister, Mr. Wadefuhl, had to call off his meeting with his visit to China when it became clear that though the Chinese were prepared to meet him, the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi was prepared to meet him, no other Chinese official was intending to meet him, so that the entire discussion would have been limited to a one-to-one discussion with Wang Yi. It turns out that Mr. Vandeford was intending to bring with him a big delegation of German businessmen. I remember how once upon a time, when she used to visit China, Angela Merkel used to do the same thing. Anyway, there was a whole troop of German businessmen and business people hoping to come to China with the German foreign minister. Except now it turns out that they won't, because the entire meeting has been called off. Germany, in accelerating economic decline, deindustrialization processes intensifying, has had the door, metaphorically speaking, slammed in its face by China. And it turns out that the Chinese not only limited the number of people that the German foreign minister would meet had he come to China, but the Chinese have also, up to now, rejected calls from the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz for a trip by him to China and a meeting between him and Xi Jinping. The Chinese are very angry with Germany, and indeed with Europe altogether, and they're making no attempt any longer to conceal the fact. China acting in this way has probably, as I said, concentrated minds in Washington, and with the Americans undertaking an assessment of their relationship with China, it does look as if, for the moment at least, the Americans are backing off. There's been, by the way, a big report by the Rand Corporation, which America's premier foreign policy think tank, which also is calling for a de-escalation, a general de-escalation with China. I don't believe myself that this is going to last for very long. I think that the United States continues fundamentally to be rivalrous and antagonistic to China. I think that the recent moves, for example, in the Caribbean to build up a major military force to overthrow the government of Venezuela, because that is clearly what is being planned, is at least in part because of concerns in the United States that China has been making inroads in Latin America, and specifically in Venezuela and in other places. And of course, the entire defense strategy apparently being talked about in the Pentagon to focus on defense of the Western Hemisphere is presumably aimed at tightening America's grip on Latin America and keeping rivals like Russia, but of course, first and foremost, China, away from the region. I suspect that this also partly explains the obsessive way in which the Trump administration continues to provide financial support to President Milei of Argentina. President Milei has, by the way, done better than many people expected in his latest election. The fact that a particular politician does better or worse in an election should never be a reason for lending his country money. The reasons for lending money to countries like Argentina should entirely be based on tough-minded calculations of economic viability. Argentina has a long history of defaults. Most economists, and I agree with them, consider that the current fixed peg of the peso, the current exchange rate of the peso relative to the dollar, which President Milei has been defending, is unsustainable and will soon collapse. It seems to me that the United States is at serious risk in Argentina of throwing good money after bad. It is strange that Donald Trump, who has been so critical of the Biden administration's financial and other support for President Zelensky of Ukraine, is happy to throw comparable vast sums of money to prop up his friend, President Milei, in Argentina. But regardless of that, one could see the logic. Keep China at bay, keep a friend in power. Ultimately, it's not about economics, it's not even about personal friendship. I think people like Colby and Rubio and President Trump himself would say that it's all about geopolitics. Geopolitics keeping China away, keeping the Western Hemisphere, under American control. That explains policy to Argentina. It explains policy with respect to Venezuela as well. Anyway, there it is. That's the game that the United States is playing at the moment. I think these trade agreements between China and the United States, their major purpose is to buy time. The United States still hopes to crack the mystery of how to refine rare earths. Ultimately, it will do so, but it will take a lot longer than I think some people in the United States imagine. And in the meantime, the Chinese have shown that they are able to make use of extended time periods when the United States is distracted elsewhere, and that they can move much faster to replicate technologies that the Americans have than the Americans can replicate technologies that the Chinese have. And the Chinese, anyway, are going to use any pause in the economic conflict between China and the United States to their advantage. But I don't believe there is any true warmth in the relationship. I don't believe that there's been any fundamental reversal of course by either side towards the other. Over the next few weeks, between now and the new year, we will see a military crisis, the military crisis in Ukraine, which is, in, by the way, already upon us. It's going to be impossible to conceal. I suspect that between now and the new year, it will also become increasingly clear, even to the United States, that the latest sanctions against Rosneft and Lukoil are not having a significant effect on the Russian economy. The Russian Central Bank chair, Elvira Nabiullina, in explaining her latest interest rate cut, 0.5%, gave her own overview of the state of the Russian economy. And it was striking that she only very briefly mentioned these sanctions. And I've been reading that India and Russia are already looking for ways to circumvent the sanctions. So we had today comments by the Russian energy minister, Sergei Tsvilyov. He said that in order to enhance the reliability of shipments, we are developing a Russian-Indian intergovernmental agreement to broaden cooperation in the seaborne delivery of oil and petroleum products. So I'm not sure exactly what is going on there, but it looks as if the Indians and the Russians are already in discussion about how they're going to circumvent the sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil. India is currently trying to negotiate a trade agreement with the United States. If by the end of the year that has either fallen apart or has been agreed, I think that thereafter India will quietly move back to its current pole position as a major buyer of Russian oil. And my own understanding is that Russian oil exports to China are almost entirely unaffected. I understand that Russian oil exports to India have been affected, but by less than some sections of the media in the West are saying. I understand that Reuters, I haven't read the article, is saying now that there's been no significant reduction in Russian oil exports as of now. I think by the end of the year, the President of the United States is going to have to accept that the sanctions he has imposed have not been the great game changer that perhaps some people have told him. And he's going to be faced with the reality that the story that Kellogg, Rubio, Zelensky, Waltz, General Kane, the Europeans have all told him, that the military situation in Donbass is in Ukraine's favour, that the Russians are not winning in Donbass, that Donbass is not about to fall, and that he doesn't therefore need to move forward with what he offered Putin and which Putin thought he had accepted when he met with Trump in Alaska. Trump is going to find that he threw that deal away and that by the end of the year, he is left with nothing. Anyway, that's my assessment of the situation up to now. Be more from me soon. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.